Nice.
All right. Okay. Hey, welcome everybody. Thanks for joining us for the latest edition of News of the Money World. My name is Darcy Ungaro, and as usual, my guest is Rupert Carlion. How are you, Rupert?
I'm very well. How are you, Darcy?
Good. I guess you're not really my guest. I guess we're like co-hosts, co-guests, co-mingled.
Yeah, but you're whatever. Good at asking questions, and you're good at kind of making me talk. Thank so you. That kind of is what a host is meant to do, isn't it?
That's true. I'm the hostess with the mostest, right?
Exactly.
No, host with the most. Yeah, let's forget that S part. So there is New Zealand. We want to talk a little about KiwiSaver, U.S. equity markets, petrodollar, a little bit around what's happening with Bitcoin and ETH, especially with the ETF being released. Tons of stuff to get through. Let's get cracking. Let's talk about the New Zealand GDP print, first of all.
Yep.
There's implications around where interest rates will go. But it's also kind of indicative of where we're at in New Zealand, which isn't too dissimilar to the rest of the world, but maybe we're kind of leading the world in what's to come. So do you want to talk to me about what we've seen in the latest GDP print here in New Zealand?
Yeah, so last week on Thursday it was, we had the announcement of GDP, the quarterly GDP statistics. And it, much to surprise, or to, definitely to my personal surprise, we did see a positive GDP growth. So 0.2% GDP growth over the year prior quarter. And I think no one was really sure whether we were going to still be in negative in recession territory or not. And I think it was kind of interesting, right? The two key things that drove that GDP print, it seemed to be consumer demand. Consumer demand remained higher than had been anticipated, which kind of contrasts pretty starkly with a lot of the other data that we're seeing around consumer confidence, manufacturing confidence, PMIs, all of the indicator data about how things are meant to be looking are coming in more negative than had been anticipated, but we still had stronger consumer demand that was there. I do think a big chunk of that is, as we're starting to see, is due to the immigration. Because we still had 2% plus immigration growth over the 12 months prior to that. And so I do think that's driving a whole lot of the demand. When we look at it back to a GDP per capita basis, it's still pretty negative, right? We're still in a very strong GDP per capita recession at kind of looking at kind of in the high ones, low twos, minus GDP over the past 12 months, which we haven't actually experienced that since the GFC. So really interesting print, kind of a lot of confusing noise and a lot of confusing signals in there. It'll be interesting to see. Well, I think the main part that we all care about is how's the Reserve Bank going to look at that?
Yeah, exactly. And I guess like with all these data points, there's so much nuance in it when you go scratching beneath the surface a little bit, like with GDP or gross domestic product, things like the rate of consumption, which is influenced by interest rates, government expenditure, investment. These are all factors that influence GDP. But when you scratch the surface beneath each one of those individual factors, there's a whole story that's going on there as well. So it's very, very simplified and distilled, these little data points that we pick up on and make comments on. And so the interesting thing is, though, that these are the same data points that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand will be looking at, which will then inform what their policy decisions are. So what the interest rates will actually need to be in the future come from this. But I find that interesting how, I guess, in a sense, how simplified these data points are and how serious the decisions are that are made off the back of them. And I guess that's probably why you need to have economists at the helm and people who actually kind of are willing to do that research, right? I'm not suggesting anything at all there.
It is, right? And I think this is one of the big things that we the big risks that we face right now, where we are in, what do we call it? Data jeopardy, where we're kind of every week we're looking at a new data point and expecting it to give the answer, whereas this is the very clear message coming out of the US Fed, which is, hold on a sec, we need to look at things holistically. We can't be reacting to data point after data point. The New Zealand Reserve Bank is staying in a slightly different camp of just saying, no, inflation, we don't see anything that kind of changes our view on inflation. But You do raise a really interesting point. If the markets are kind of jumping on every single possible data point, to be fair, that's because you've got a whole lot of commentators that are paid to do that, and people wanting to prove that they're smart, so that's why they do it. But it is important to kind of think one data point actually means very little, particularly when the output kind of doesn't really correlate with all the inputs, which is what we've seen here.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And it is pretty interesting, right? Because you look at the market reaction to this, and just looking down at my kind of at my screens on the other side, and actually there's been very little movement in interest rates over the course of the last week. So kind of indicating that, you know what, most people are going, it's a bit of a move, but it's a bit of a nil print and hasn't really changed any perspectives or any views on when interest rates are going to change. I think it depends on what camp you're in. If you're in the camp of higher for longer, then you take the strong demand as kind of the leading factor of what you want to look at. If you're in the camp of kind of interest rates are going to come down then quickly, then you look pretty carefully at the, all of the other underlying factors that, that are kind of meant to be driving GDP and how negative they are and go, well, this is just an aberration and it's only a matter of time before it comes crashing down. So there's there's something in that print for absolutely anyone and to come up with any story you want.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, which that, by the way, like that's actually a really profound point that you just said, I think, which warrants further examination, right? Like you can torture the data to confess to whatever you want. And that's kind of what happens, right? Like when we try to explain what's happening in the world, or even when we try to understand it, we first download the operating system or a baseline understanding or some sort of mental framework to figure it out. But then, and I found this out recently just by looking at one of the topics on our menu today, the petrodollar thing, just how if you have one operating system to view the world, when the world changes, you have to really re-examine those operating systems or those baseline assumptions, because more often than not, they're flawed or they're limited in some way. And again, you have to apply another level of nuance to it, scratch beneath the surface, unlock deeper meaning. Okay, now I want to talk to you about KiwiSaver. You know a little bit about KiwiSaver, Rupert. You should know a little bit about KiwiSaver, you know, heading up for a KiwiSaver. And the FMA, I was just reading something about the Financial Markets Authority this morning. They were talking about how important it is now that we're at that 12-month mark. Once a year, it's very, very strongly recommended that you consider having a look at your KiwiSaver. Ask yourself these four questions. This is, again, from the FMA, not necessarily from me, but they would suggest look at these following four questions. What is your KiwiSaver balance right now? Are you in the right investment fund for your circumstances? What could your balance be at age 65? And do the fees that you pay look reasonable? Problems with all those questions, to be honest, in terms of the limitations with those ones. But starting with that first one, where are we in terms of average balances? So like thinking about the average member at Kura KiwiSaver, what would be average in terms of what the average member would have with you guys?
So our average balance is about $42,000, which we understand is kind of, we'll get some more accurate data when the FMA's KiwiSaver annual report comes out later in the year, but we think we're a little bit above the market average. So market average is currently sitting in that high 30s is our understanding. So to be blunt, it's not enough. We kind of, particularly when you look at the age skews of where people are at, we know people need kind of somewhere in that kind of $800 to $1 million for a comfortable retirement. And there are very few people with those numbers at the moment. So it's a good prompt for people to think about their contribution rates. Hopefully your provider has got, on your statements, you will be seeing what does your forecast look like. Hopefully your provider's got some cool tools on their website that you can play around with the different contribution rates and go, well, actually, if I move my contribution rate from 3%, 6%, 8%, what does that do? Because you don't want to be kind of left, kind of get it arriving at 50 or 55 and going, fuck, I've only got $50,000 saved away. Where do I get that extra $1 million from?
Sure. How much you invest, how long that runway is between now and retirement, and what type of fund you're in are really, really important questions. And so
They are, right?
Yeah.
And I think what you, because none of these are easy questions. Like, let's be honest. That's the problem with KiwiSaver. It's people think about it as a bank product, but none of these are easy questions. And so my strong suggestion is, if you're not sure, call up your KiwiSaver provider. I mean, Kotta would love to help you, but you will have a KiwiSaver provider already. And I think what is telling for that KiwiSaver provider is, can they answer those questions for you and can they give you comfort? And exactly. If they can't give you comfort that you're doing the right things and that you've got all the information you need, hate to say it, you're probably in the wrong space.
Exactly. And that's the number four question, right? Do the fees I pay in dollars actually look reasonable? Like, if you're not actually getting advice, and we need to kind of qualify what that word advice means, are you really getting value out of it? In my opinion, you shouldn't be paying a high fee with the expectation that you're automatically entitled to a high return, because that, again, is oversimplifying the matter. But if you're getting advice not just around how KiwiSaver works and getting factual, correct answers around KiwiSaver, that's great. But you kind of also need to get answers around what fund you should be in for your specific circumstances, yep. I believe. And that's where you can really turn up the knob, really, in terms of where you're going to end up in the long term if you get more holistic advice and how KiwiSaver fits into the broader picture, in my view.
And I 100%. And it comes back to kind of that point about you get, at the end of the day, to a certain extent, you get what you pay for. There are a couple of very low-priced KiwiSaver managers in the market. But they kind of say, if you want to talk to us, or if you want any help, email us and we'll try and get back to you in 3 to 5 business days. So I think that you just, it's not all about fees. It's about kind of understanding, can they help you arrive at the same outcome, at the kind of the right outcomes? Because answering those three questions and being confident in your contribution rate right, and are you in the right type of fund, that is going to be far more important and do far more for you as a person than saving 0.3 to 0.5% in fees.
Yeah. I think some people might learn that lesson later than others, unfortunately, and there's a lot of marketing. We'll call it what it is. It's propaganda, or it's PR. It's spin to sell whatever the narrative is, right? Like, hey, it's about passive investing. It's about active investing. It's about being able to choose your own. It's about low cost. There's all these sorts of narratives that are competing for that fee that you're going to pay. But if it's not actually helping you arrive at the destination, if it's just getting you to focus on the tools, not at what you're trying to build, yeah. So KiwiSaver, though, I think like it's so important. It is the next cab off the rank. It's the next thing that you want to be thinking about after, like seriously thinking about after you've either decided to buy a home or not decided to buy a home. But on the topic of property, where a lot of New Zealanders will plow chunks.
Well, actually, before we go to property, I think the one call out I would also like to do, so for people that are slightly skeptical on KiwiSaver, I think it's also really important that we celebrate what an amazing year it has been for KiwiSaver and KiwiSaver members, right? Sure. I mean, so I'm just looking at the average stats at the moment and going, the average growth fund delivered 15% returns last year. So that's 15% returns. They've delivered over the last kind of 5 years, 7.5% annual returns annualized in a growth fund. That's pretty impressive, right? And so I think we've got a, last year was, like, let's be honest, last year was about as good as it's ever going to get. Not even I can pretend that that's a normal outcome. But I think it is a good thing. And so for people that are going, well, why would I put my money in KiwiSaver? Why would I do this? Why would I do that? That's why. And also coming back to the different fund types, right? The average of the aggressive funds did 19% last year. And the average of the conservative funds did 9% last year. So look, depending on your time horizon, that is the cost of being in the right or the wrong fund. So yeah, so there's all the technical stuff, but we can't forget that, hey, it's been a great year and it's time to celebrate. KiwiSaver has created a lot of wealth for a lot of Kiwis over the last 12, 18 months.
Yeah. No, good call. Even just 7%, right? Like if you could average out a 7% return after fees and taxes, that would be amazing. But that's going to turn 100 grand into 200 grand in 10 years. It's as simple as that at 7%. Yeah. So yeah, like I guess that's saying a couple of things, right? Like set your expectations lower for the long term is one thing. But also you don't want to get hooked on these rates of return that we've seen, because usually following really good returns and Murphy's Law, you'll get low returns because that it's on average, you're going to get probably 7 to 8% depending on the fund that you're in, right?
Exactly right. And so it's the average is what we're looking at, but we're still allowed to celebrate when it works well.
You're allowed to just for a little bit there, Rupert. Don't get too carried away now.
It's just for a little bit. I kind of, it's nice though, right? Like me as a fund manager, it's really nice when our clients do well. And I think in coming back to the negativity and the negative environment that we're currently living in, it's really hard to forget this great news story, right? I mean, I tell our people, a US equities fund, which is up 35% over the last 12 months. And I tell people, then they're like, nah, that's impossible. That's a scam. It's kind of just recognizing that our media are talking about the New Zealand stuff. Our media are talking about what's happening here. But actually, our KiwiSaver is invested offshore. And actually, the dynamics that are being experienced by the offshore markets are very different to what we're seeing here. So, it's a really great news story. And it shows the power of diversification in the current environment.
Yeah, no, well said. So what I was saying before, though, around property, a lot of Kiwis will just use their home as their investment vehicle, right? And so that's why I think KiwiSaver is such a good next step for a lot of people to take really seriously. Like when they think that they're going to be debt-free when they want it to be debt-free, then it's time to start really putting the hammer down because we don't know if property is going to be like the be-all and end-all, right? And I question this all the time. I love property, big fan of it myself. But we don't know. Hence, diversification around some key bets, really important. We've seen in the last year, kind of like what you were saying around growth rates of KiwiSaver funds, we've seen property values in places like Australia and the US. Obviously, this isn't true in every single sub area. We've seen pretty strong or at least resilient growth rates in those areas, despite the high interest rates. In New Zealand, it's a little bit of a different story, I think, but we've seen relatively resilient property markets around the Western world. And in a period of high interest rates, it has some people scratching their heads. I know. Look, I wonder if this is somewhat connected to what we started with GDP, which is actually not that bad. And I wonder if it just says something about the strength of the consumer or the ability or the firepower that consumers still have in the form of unspent credit where they could still either access credit or they have cash reserves that they could deploy. But what's your thinking around why property prices, I've got a couple of theories, but what's your thinking around why property prices have been so resilient and that actually have grown in the last little while?
I think there's two things, right? One is consumers. There's three things in my mind. One is consumers have done really, really well over the last, and kind of everyday people over the last 3 or 4 years, right? We've seen significant wage growth. That's kind of plus. So kind of people have actually been able to afford to do more than they have in the past. At the same time, we've seen massive population growth, right? So those markets that we talked about and no difference in New Zealand, all of them, so New Zealand, Australia, the US, we're all looking at 2% plus population growth over the last 12 months. And it's likely, well, New Zealand will probably slow down, but Australia and the US are going to continue. And so what that's doing is that's driving very strong demand for properties. That's driving very strong demand, and kind of it comes back to the global problem. We just have not been building anywhere near enough houses, unless you're in China where they've been building way too many. But it's a tough one. So yeah, my view is it's the strong consumer that's had pretty significant pay rises, not enough housing supply. And it also comes back to what the third piece, which we've always talked about, which is it's actually property is a nice inflation hedge because as kind of demand tightens up or supply tightens up, demand stays strong, we get acceleration in prices. And even if you look at the inflation data at the moment, rents are actually one of the biggest drivers of inflation offshore. Less so in New Zealand, but which kind of is indicative of the supply and demand, and we haven't built anywhere near enough houses.
Yeah, took the words all right out of my mouth there, Rupert. So 100%.
Sorry.
No, that's good. But that's interesting, though. Like, again, there's more than one way to explain what's going on.
Yeah.
But it just, I am like genuinely surprised. We've seen interest rates go very high and stay there for very long. I don't know how long. Maybe it's towards the end of this year. Maybe it's next year before we get any significant decreases in interest rates. But if it's this resilient during a high interest rate environment because of the factors that you've mentioned, lack of supply, immigration being the two big ones that I would be pointing at, imagine what happens when interest rates drop. Like, will property reinflate, like just go bananas again? And if so, given our recent experience just with the angst around the inequality piece, will that lead to another round of government intervention where they try to stamp out that? Or will they let it run this time? We have a different government in charge this time around. Should that occur within the next few years? I don't know. Like, do you kind of see the property market, if interest rates do decrease, in the absence of other factors going on, do you see that it has still a little bit of life in it where it could just take off again? Or do you think that we've kind of grown up a little bit and we're a bit more subdued with the whole thing of a property?
I think, to me, it comes back to exactly the same conversation that I just said, right? I think we still have a massive undersupply of housing, which is hard to see that being fixed at any point in time, right? When you think about it, we've got net population growth of 200,000 people a year. So that means there's a demand for kind of call that 80 to 100,000 houses a year, and we're only building 40. So that doesn't feel like a very good set of maths to me. Yeah. So I think the supply and demand dynamics don't change. I think the interest rates kind of coming down. One of the big things to me, though, is what causes those interest rates to come down. And increasingly, I'm taking the view that probably it is the inflation falling off a cliff. It is immigration falling off a cliff, because that's what's going to drive a whole lot of that demand side, consumer demand, out of the economy as well. So that's where I kind of struggle to see. I know in a perfect world, potentially the market is far more resilient than we expect, but I don't think it is a perfect world, because I think we will see, if we see interest rate cuts, it's because we've seen kind of a bit more economic pain and issues on the other side. And then the third thing I think that's really important for us to point out and raise, our house prices to income are still by far and away the highest in the world. Mm. We still have, by any objective measure, one of the most expensive property markets around. And so that's the final piece of the puzzle, which to me goes, that's the bit that I struggle with probably the most. Actually, they kind of have to come down, and they can't really reaccelerate, because people, if we're looking at a 5%, even if we're looking at 5% mortgage rates, people can't afford that. If you're sitting there kind of, you're living in outskirts of Auckland, you've paid $1.2 million for a house, because there are no suburbs in Auckland anymore with an average house price under $1 million. $800,000 mortgage, you're paying 40 grand a year on interest, and you've got household income of $80,000. That makes no sense. Yeah. Like, that just does not stack up in any environment that I can think of.
That's right. Yeah, 30 to 40%, not 40 to 50% of your income really is where you kind of want to be thinking with. So that's one of those things that would indicate that. And then you wonder, well, if that's the future world that we're heading into, where maybe house prices have another, 10, 15% to drop before it equalizes, there's a bit of pain.
But the problem is that rents continue to rise, right? And so it comes back to, this massive rental dynamic here in the New Zealand market, which I increasingly wonder how much of that is driven by subsidies. And I'd love to know kind of how much of that is driven by the market rents keep on getting pushed up, but actually the big chunk of the population pay isn't really moving because it's capped as a percentage of their income. So there's a couple of interesting dynamics in that I wonder how much of it is, where some of that stuff sits actually.
Interesting. But rents would basically have to double to equal the 80% mortgage that one would have to pay for a typical home price. So that's, rents are definitely going to help with this. But the only other levers to pull is house prices and interest rates.
But rents can't go, to my book, again, right? Rents can't go any higher. I mean, I've got a whole series of staff working for me. And I mean, I don't know the actual number, but I'm assuming average rental in Auckland for a 3-bedroom kind of is probably $600 a week. That's 30 grand a year that someone's paying. And again, when you've got average household income of kind of 80, and it doesn't make sense, right? The numbers don't make sense whether on a mortgage level or on a rent level.
That's exactly right. And this isn't a New Zealand only phenomenon. This is happening all over the place where people genuinely can't afford to live in a home with a normal job. That's just not possible. And so again, there's two other levers. It's either interest rates come down or house prices come down, because it's not getting any cheaper to manufacture these homes. A lot of that is entrenched with regulation, and it's just really expensive to get that product out the door. But it's hard to see how that solution sort of fixes itself without some pain being felt by some segments of the economy. It is what it is.
Which I know this is a very unpopular theory, but which is why I personally think the only solution to this is mass building programs. And I would actually like to see the government go and do that. I think particularly if we're coming into an economic downturn, if the government said, you know what, we're just going to scoop up all of these offshore, these tradies that are currently heading to Australia, and we're going to launch a program and try and build 20,000 houses.
Yeah.
I think that's the right answer right now, because that'll allow us to maintain. One of the big issues with the New Zealand cycles is we do a great job at building during when boom times. And then the moment the tide turns, we stop building, and then it takes us another five. When the tide gets better again, we take another 5 years to build the infrastructure to be able to start building again.
That's right.
And in my mind, the government's the entity that should be kind of going right now, and I know this is very unpopular with the current government, right now is when they actually need to be really ramping up their building activity. They shouldn't have been doing it in the last 2 or 3 years because the private sector was doing it, but now it's kind of up to the government and using their balance sheet to carry us through.
Yeah, well, at the very least, whatever they have to do to make that happen, i.e. get rid of some of the regulation and red tape that stops these new titles being created, they're going to have to do that themselves, right? So I think indirectly I agree with you, but only because I know that the core issue is actually the government itself and the rules that they've imposed on actually creating more units of occupation. So if the private sector wants to fund that, they should have the freedom. But yeah, if the government wants to get more involved, they'll have to fix the mess that they put us in to start with around not actually creating that. But let's move on, shall we, and talk about things that are less opaque or less, I guess, convoluted and full of...
I'd say more opaque. Factors.
What's that? More opaque? No way. Well, this is... okay, you think I'm talking about point number four, but I'm actually going to go off script here and talk about a really interesting news event that I think, and probably rightly so, kind of got forgotten a little bit. And this was the Ethereum ETF, Ethereum ETF approval. So the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States, did the first step in approving they've approved the concept of an Ethereum spot ETF, not a futures contract one, so that, you know, it's more pure, right? Like the Bitcoin ETF that was approved, that we're all now able to access. So now we're just waiting for the specific approval of the actual funds that we can start to buy. And when you look at the price of Ethereum, and it's interesting, I did a podcast with Paul Quickenden from Easy Crypto last week around that. And interestingly, it was $3,500 or so for the price of one Ethereum. Then it's $3,200 today. So there's some funky stuff going on in terms of just some sideways chop happening in the crypto market in general. But I think with the Ethereum approval in the wind here, it's surprising in a way that the price action hasn't been more positive. People haven't really been kind of feeding that through and wanting to front run this as much as the what happened with the Bitcoin ETF, which in a way kind of triggered a premature bull run. And a lot of people would sort of point to the fact that Bitcoin and Ethereum are very different assets. Bitcoin is a store of wealth. So it makes sense that a financialized wrapper of an exchange traded fund makes sense as an alternative holding vehicle for a lot of investors, and it makes it easier for institutions to get into it. Whereas with an Ethereum ETF, it makes it easier for investors to get into it, but Ethereum, in my mind anyway, is meant to be used, not meant to be hodled, not meant to be held. It's not necessarily a store of value. It's a software platform, in a sense, a decentralized software platform. You want to build on it. And so, it'll still go up in price potentially the more that network gets adopted and used, but I think that it's probably symptomatic of regulators and even investors to a certain extent not really understanding that crypto is not a homogenous Coke and Pepsi type situation. These are fundamentally different types of assets completely. But it's just really interesting just to see how it hasn't really triggered the same sort of euphoria and optimism in the market for the number two crypto out there, I think.
We with our crypto fund, we actually went and asked a whole lot of some of our larger investors what they would prefer, whether we kind of open it up outside of Bitcoin. And the feedback we got was actually pretty clear. They want us to keep it at Bitcoin for exactly the reasons that you have said. It's the long-term hold product. Ethereum, even Ethereum has not been seen as having that store of value because they think it's more exposed to technological risk and other products as well. Yeah. So I think it will be harder to get the institutions there. I also think last time the institutions were and people were slightly burnt when it kind of dropped from that 49 back down to 38, 39, again, after the go live. So people are probably just waiting to see where that demand sits. My question to you, because I haven't actually looked at this in a huge amount of detail, is why is it taking so long? Do you know why? Because like the Bitcoin ETFs, the approval came through, and then we were like only weeks away from products being launched and approved. But this feels as though it's taking a very long time. Have you got any idea why?
The only thing that I could speculate on is that the market just – or the participants genuinely didn't think that it was going to be approved. They didn't necessarily factor in the political interference, perhaps, that went on, where, hey, it became now something that, hey, if Trump's going to support it, well, then we got to support it. Let's rush it through. And maybe just the timing caught people off guard. It's hard to say. The other part of it is that these Ethereum spot ETFs, in the U.S. anyway, probably won't allow for staking. So there won't be the ability to convert and use that Ethereum to generate yield, which is kind of one of the benefits of Ethereum over Bitcoin, is that you can generate.
That's an important point, right?
Yeah. So I don't know. Good.
It'll be interesting to see, right? I mean, I'm still hopeful that we start to see some slightly more evolved products around kind of some top 10 funds and some of that stuff, right? So we start to see some more, some slightly more interesting funds that become available. But the one thing I do know is, or I assume, sorry, is I think the institutional custody solutions, that might also be part of the issue because when we looked at this last year, institutional grade custody for Bitcoin was really easy. Institutional grade crypto for others, nowhere near as easy. So I do wonder whether there's a little bit of that's kind of happening as well.
That's an important, I didn't pick up on that. So that's an important one to think about as well. What are the other things though that I think just we should be mindful of when we are investing in general is that there are multiple ways to access the same asset. And with exchange-traded funds, we now have a traditional avenue to access a very nascent technology, and we have the ability to own a piece of it. We didn't really have the ability to own a piece of the internet when it became popular. We had to kind of focus more on the applications running on it, the websites and everything with the .com at the end of it. But with this time around, we have the ability to own pieces of like a Web3 value-based internet-y type network. We can own chunks of that right now. And it's not necessarily a given that the strategy we should follow to invest in it is through traditional financial rails, through ETFs. I think that is an option, but it isn't the highest pinnacle. It's not like crypto has arrived because you can invest in a crypto ETF. It's just one of the ways that you might want to investigate getting exposure into it. But I think that the real value is in allowing these digital assets to spawn their own networks and use cases and see where that runs. Like Ethereum is a classic case. Ethereum and Solana, classic cases of how they might eventually build out new financial rails that actually make the traditional financial rails look like the horse and carriage. And I think that's just something that a lot of mainstream investors will not figure out until it's already happened. But that's kind of what they're doing by getting these ETFs, is they're banking on the success without actually knowing how the whole thing works. And you can do that to a point, but I think there is value in actually understanding a little bit more about how these things work.
But I do, I 100%, but I also believe the one thing that ETFs are doing is they're making the entry point a whole lot easier for people. And by making it more accessible, then you get people as the teaser, right? So how I describe it is kind of selling my own book here, but the dream crypto journey, right, is your interest in crypto. So you put a little bit in your KiwiSaver because it's super easy and you just kind of tick a button and you're done. You don't need to do much and you're a long-term holder. That goes pretty well. You decide you like it. You might then go put a little bit of KiwiSaver, buy a little bit of the ETF because, again, that's pretty easy and you can go above and you can put a bit more. And then you've kind of started to understand the dynamics. You've started to understand the volatility. You've started to understand. You go, okay, cool. Now I might go have a look at other products. But what, and also you're going to go, cool, at that point you're invested, right? So you're going, I've now got $5,000 or $10,000 invested in this kind of crypto world and I kind of decide I want to do a little bit more. At that point, you're going to start to do a whole lot of research on a wallet and kind of move into there. So for me, I agree. These aren't necessarily the best long-term holders for people, but they are great vehicles to introduce and get people into the asset class I personally believe that the current infrastructure is still way too complicated for the average investor.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And it's still evolving as well. But that's like going back to kind of what we started with, or a lot of what we talked about today, is that for people who kind of traditionally go to property as their source of wealth that will somehow fund their retirement, KiwiSaver is kind of like the next step, right? And then when you get into KiwiSaver, the whole world opens up. Maybe I could actually buy exchange-traded funds in similar things that my KiwiSaver fund is investing in. Maybe I could get individual exposure into these, you know, magnificent seven companies. And then, yeah, maybe I can get some exposure into crypto. And then that leads to direct exposure into crypto where you self-custody it. It's just all a journey, right? But I think there is a pathway that every everyday investor should follow where you start off just doing it. And then once you've done it, that's when you actually start to learn it. Because the more skin in the game you have, the more responsibility, I guess, you have. But also, and maybe this is why that feeds back into these exponential growth curves in markets, is that if most investors are increasing their exposure as their confidence increases, then that leads to more money being invested in these markets, which then has a positive feedback loop as well. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree. Great opportunity though, right? Coming full circle. I think how you've described it is great. You start in kind of using KiwiSaver, using your property experience, using your house to go, actually use them all as education experiences to figure out what makes you a better investor.
Totally. Because we're all different, right? Yeah. Awesome. Well, again, there's stuff that we didn't get to on the list here that we wanted to, but we'll put it on the list for next week.
And we'll cover next week.
Yeah.
And we've been meaning to talk about Ethereum for 3 weeks and we finally got there, so that's good.
We do tick these things off the list, so we will get to the petrodollar. We will get to the forecast around the US equity market, so all in due time. Awesome. All right, well, have a great week, Rupert, and we'll look forward to catching up with you next week.
Thanks, Darcy. We'll speak next week.
Cheers.
Bye.
Cool. Hey, next week, by the way.
I need a piece of content.